Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Great to be back with you. Happy that you're spending the last few hours of your weekend with us tonight. We've got some cool conversation lined up for the next 4 hours. One central theme with both of our main topics and guests tonight is the alluring nature of the unknown, the way it can sink its hooks into us, draws us in, captures us for all time. James McLennan is an example. He's a sociologist, has a PhD. He's a man of science, a careful, rational researcher who set out decades ago to study people who might be described as deviants, a deviant subculture, a unique population that had largely been ignored by his fellow sociologists and grad students. Call them spiritualists, and I use that term in kind of the loosest way possible because in the sense of tonight's discussion, it includes not only true believers who try to contact spirits or the dead or beings on some other plane of existence through methods often employed by mediums, but it also includes scientists, hard-boiled investigators, who dared to take on topics that almost always lead to ridicule and scorn in their professional circles. Dr. McLennan set out to expose frauds, charlatans, and hucksters, or that's what he figured they were going to be. He figured the people who claim to be in contact with disembodied spirits must be pulling some kind of tricks, sleight of hand, skullduggery, pulling the wool over the eyes of gullible people. But a funny thing happened over the years. He got hooked. He was part of a group that had ongoing communication, conversations even, with unknown entities that managed to pull off some pretty astonishing maneuvers. If they're tricks, they're very good tricks. He's written several books about the ongoing communications with the, call it the supernatural, if you want. The latest book is called The Entity Letters, and it's a page-turner, for sure. Dr. McLennan joins me in the second half of the program tonight with firsthand eyewitness stories and some physical evidence that really should raise a goosebump or two. But first, something closer to home. You know, many of you have likely heard about the contactee movement of the 50s and 60s. This was long before alien abductions were widely known about. The contactees were often charismatic leaders, almost like gurus, who claimed to have had ongoing communication with space visitors, people from Venus or from Mars or from some other worlds farther out that we had never heard of before. The space people would deliver these sweeping messages like alien editorials, often words of warning about how Earthlings were headed in the wrong direction, sort of like the warnings in that old sci-fi classic, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And one of the best-known contactees was George Van Tassel, who helped organize these massive UFO-themed gatherings at a place called Giant Rock in the Mojave Desert, Southern California. And I'll tell you, I don't know if you've been there, but Giant Rock is aptly named. We've mentioned it many times on this program before. That whole area around Joshua Tree seems to be like a magnet for a subset of people. Artists, musicians, hermits, people who want to drop out, go off the grid, creative people, spiritual people, and more than a few crazy people. And I say that with fondness because I've spent a lot of time out there. There is a vibe to that part of the world for sure. In the National Park, the Joshua Tree National Park, in places like Landers and Pioneer Town, a lot of famous people hide out there, along with some infamous folks as well, I'm sure. And a lot of people who come for a visit never leave. George Van Tassel was drawn to Giant Rock. He moved his family out there and started a movement. And he left behind a very strange structure known as the Integratron, based on designs that he says the space people beamed into his head. He said this thing would be a part-time time machine, kind of a part-time rejuvenator, a miracle healer, a life extender. A lot of people thought he was a loon. The FBI thought he might be a commie, but people who knew him believed him then, and they believe him now, And a filmmaker named Jonathan Berman spent a lot of time on the ground in and around Joshua Tree to put together a wonderful new documentary film, Calling All Earthlings is the title. I watched it today. It is immensely entertaining, and it focuses on an almost forgotten slice of Americana, of American life. Jonathan Berman joins me momentarily. In the news, perhaps you heard about the death of Dr. Michael Persinger. He was a well-known scientist who pursued paranormal subjects with great vigor. I think he probably enraged and challenged ufologists, ESP investigators, among others. The God Helmet, you ever heard of that? It was his idea. And he suggested prosaic explanations for things like near-death experiences and other psychic phenomena, even though he believed psychic phenomena to be true. Dr. Persinger died this past week. Also heard some statements from Dr. Jacques Vallée that in which he basically says he's moving on from ufology, moving away from it. Says he's had enough. Doesn't think the field is making any progress whatsoever, so he's calling it quits. And I really hope that isn't true. I've expressed my opinion about Jacques Vallée on this program many times. And I am also told that Dr. Vallée has expressed similar sentiments in previous years. Hopefully, whatever he does in the future will still relate to larger questions that we're all pursuing, even if he does not call it ufology. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from various media sources around the world. We call it Naps News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Among the stories posted there tonight, can't believe I have to say this, but there's a story about scientific evidence proving why the Earth is not flat. Why the Earth is not flat. And I'm not going to get into details because I shouldn't have to. I mentioned Jacques Vallée a moment ago. We have a piece about his recent take on consciousness as it relates to the emergence of the World Wide Web. And a related subject, artificial intelligence. You know, we're on the cusp of some truly momentous changes, economic and social changes, as machines take more and more jobs that have, until now, been done by humans. What do all of us do when the world's economy doesn't need us anymore, doesn't need us to do much of anything? I'm sure our corporate overlords will take good care of us, right? Housing, medical care? Maybe not. Little update about the To the Stars Academy, which has been pretty busy of late testing weird samples of unknown material. We got a story about it, and also a brief video interview with primatologist Dr. Jane Goodall, in which she is asked for probably the umpteenth time what she thinks about Bigfoot. She's also asked about the possibility of intelligent ET life. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by her answers to both of those. Interesting clips, anyway. That and more in Naps News tonight. And while you're there on the Coast site, you can check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. It gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs that you can watch anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any device, along with other special benefits for members. And you can subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which delves into many of the topics similar to what we do here on radio. With that, let's get down to business. Assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat. In fact, maybe you need another dog and cat. Bring them in. Put on a pot of Joe. Slip out of those work clothes and shimmy into some silky jammies. Slide into those penny loafers. Plop down on a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, the legacy of George Van Tassel, as told in Calling All Earthlings, the new film by producer Jonathan Berman. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. The Mojave Desert attracts all kinds of characters, and it's been that way for centuries. The original inhabitants, indigenous peoples, believe to this day that they arrived in the Mojave from a different planet, that they were brought here by someone else and were dropped off. And ever since then, the residents of Joshua Tree and that general area believe that they have communicated with entities that are sometimes called star people. In the 1950s, the area around Joshua Tree became the center of the UFO universe, in part because of an aerospace guy named George Van Tassel and the messages he says he received from space beings. Van Tassel started a movement, and the remnants are still there to be found, both physical structures and the people who knew and respected Van Tassel. Jonathan Berman is a professor of film and video at Cal State University San Marcos. He makes films that redefine how alternative ideas and communities are presented. His documentaries often explore third spaces, which are spaces outside the home or work that hold a particular passion for people. We can relate to that, right? His latest film is titled Calling All Earthlings. It's a what you'd call a gentle exploration of the George Van Tassel tale. This is his first time on the program. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you, George.
So how did you, had you spent much time in Joshua Tree in that area before you embarked on this project?
I hadn't spent any time there, actually. I was always intrigued by the desert, you know, growing up in back east. And it was always just a magical place for me. And one day I was at the Bodhi Tree. I don't know if you remember that bookstore in Los Angeles. And it's a paranormal bookstore. And I was looking through the books and I saw this picture of the dome, the Integratron. And I was like, what is that building that has this Gothic look and this sign on it that says, for basic experimentation into life extension? I'm like, I have to go there. I didn't realize it was going to lead me down this rabbit hole journey.
You know, my description of Joshua Tree is sort of a magnet for dreamers and hermits and artists and musicians, creative people, crazy people, not too far off the mark, would you say?
I think you're right. You're right in the pocket, George. And, you know, I was just talking with a friend, and the other side of crazy, of course, is genius.
Yeah. One of the people in your film, and I'm not going to dwell on it too much now, we'll come back to it later, but one of the people featured in your film is Eric Burdon, singer, best known for his work in The Animals, still performs. I saw him here a year ago in Las Vegas. He's still great. He got hooked. He mentions that the place was a magnet for him, and I don't know if he was familiar with the Van Tassel story in general or that was part of it, but you use him as an example of how this place is a draw for all sorts of people, right?
Yeah, and it's funny that you bring up Eric Burdon, because I was just sorting through the extra footage and figuring out, well, what goes on the DVD, Blu-ray for extras, and I found Eric's story. You know, it turned out he had gone to the low desert, right, Palm Springs, for his health, leaving the city, and had just heard about the monument, Joshua Tree Monument. He thought it was a monument with Howard Hughes and, you know, Marilyn Monroe on it, like a statue, and then was wandering around the park, possibly had taken some kind of cactus, I'm not really sure, and found himself at the Integratron, and wrote this incredible story about a German major and George Van Tassel. So, you know, these places, these special places, can act as like talismans and you know, inspire creativity.
Well, that's certainly true for Giant Rock, you know, and I mentioned I've been there a lot of times, and it is aptly named. That is one big rock, and it's been a draw for Native American, Indigenous people, and everyone since. But, you know, it would never occur to me that that's a place I'd like to live, let alone live there with my wife and three kids, which is what George Van Tassel decided to do. What was he thinking?
You know, that rock has a huge history, right? It goes, some say there's ley lines, you know, like meridians as an acupuncture. I'm sure you've done shows on ley lines. And before George lived there, it was the home of a man named George Kreitzer, who was an emigre, a German emigre. And George Kreitzer was a miner, and George Kreitzer had dynamite, and it was World War II, and he had started a landing strip. He was squatting there, basically. And the police wanted to see what was happening with Kreitzer. And they came out, and, you know, there's different versions of the story, but they blew him up. And Kreitzer and Tassel, Van Tassel, were friends. George Van Tassel went out and took his place in the cooling chamber underneath the rock. And if you've been out there, there is some kind of draw. There's, as you said, a draw to the area, but specifically that spot. So George was drawn there. It was the end of World War II, and working in the factories for people like Lockheed and Hughes, Howard Hughes in particular, who figures into the story. And he brought his family out there to sleep under the stars and, you know, to get out of the rat race. You know, even back then, the city has this hum of electricity. It's only when you get out of the city that you can really connect.
Let's talk about Van Tassel. Give me the thumbnail sketch about who he was before he became the Van Tassel that we know of from the contactee movement, what he had done. I know you mentioned about him working at aerospace, and we've all read that before, that he worked for Howard Hughes and Lockheed and Douglas Aircraft, I think, is the other one. But the descriptions of what he actually did range from a security guy who checked for safety devices to test pilot to aeronautical engineer. And you kind of, you don't delve too deeply into that. And I get the feeling that it, as I described the film, it's kind of a gentle treatment of this subject matter. You don't press those buttons too hard. Is that by design?
It's not necessarily pressing the buttons, but it's one of the things I love about this story is that there's a multiplicity of voices, right? So it's not fair and balanced because there's 100 different viewpoints. One thing I can tell you is that George Van Tassel was a union leader. He had worked on the assembly lines. He had worked at those three aircraft facilities you mentioned. And according to a recent filing that's now making the Integratron and the area around it a historical place, he had some aerospace training back in Ohio, was always in love with airplanes, was always a thinker, and just was drawn out here to continue that love of airplanes, and had worked personally for use. That's in contention. I believe it. And if you read this document that I'll post on our website, callingallearthlingsmovie.com, you might agree.
Well, I mean, I watched these clips that you have secured and have in the film, and I had seen some of them before because I had done some stories about him as well. It's great. It's obvious he's a pretty smart guy. He's well-spoken. He knows his stuff. He's no dummy. I'm just wondering if you could sort of share with us what was going into his thinking about moving out there, because he had fairly stable life and sounds like he had a good job, but three kids and a wife, and boom, then he moves to Giant Rock and let's dig a hole and live in the desert.
Well, some would say that he moved out towards the desert to work with Howard Hughes at the Harper Dry Lake test site, where Hughes was working on some secret aircraft. So that's a possibility. Some would say, remember Green Acres?
Sure.
He just wanted to hit the country and get out of the rat race. So this is what I love about this story. You know, there's many different versions of it.
But I just imagine, I've been out there in the summertime. It's brutal.
Oh, yeah.
And to move your wife and kids out there and basically build, he built a little cafe, served burgers and apple pie, and that must have been a really tough existence.
Well, you know, when George moved there, and it was after the war, there were less jobs in Los Angeles on assembly lines, right, and running aircraft facilities. You know, excuse me, he was a devout guy, and he was a Christian, and he was strong and striking, and, you know, like a farmer, sort of. And he began these weekly meditations in 1949. They were actually prayer sessions, like Christian prayer sessions. And that was George's, you know, he grew up in that milieu. And at one point, he talked about entering this area of golden mist, and he heard a voice speaking. So it was like a community event that was a religious event that sort of moved in the direction of what they call channeling. And in 1952, yeah, they were just making their hardscrabble existence, living out there. He heard a different kind of voice, and those were the voices of space people. And they had weird names, you know, Hulda and Lata and Molka and, of course, Ashtar.
You describe it in the film as it's not him. It's not Van Tassel who is awoken at night by the spaceship landing. It's his son-in-law.
His son-in-law.
And how the son-in-law got there is also a story we'll get into. But the son-in-law hears this noise, this ship lands, and Van Tassel has an encounter with a being.
Yeah, the landing is—it's quite a story, and it's quite an experience. And you know, there's some things that you can talk about intellectually that you can't necessarily talk about, you know, connect with on a visceral level. Like you have to experience certain things, right? So, you know, the landing was a full moon, as it often is in these kind of circumstances. So there was a lot of light. And it was August 1953, and George said that a ship from Venus landed, and a man wearing a jumpsuit stood out at the foot of his sleeping bag, and he said, "I am Solgonda, and I would be pleased to show you my craft. And
Well, that's the opening line of a great story. We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll pick it up from there, and you can tell us what Sol Gonda told Van Tassel, what he saw, and how that changed his life. We're talking with Jonathan Berman about Calling All Earthlings, his new film. We'll tell you how you can see it in a moment. Well, we're talking about Calling All Earthlings, the new film by Jonathan Berman about George Van Tassel. As we just heard, in August of 1953, Van Tassel met an alien being named Sol Gonda, and the conversation that they had, that he reported them having, of course, changed Van Tassel's life and affected a lot of other people as well. In a moment, we'll hear what Sol Gonda had to say to Van Tassel and where that led. My colleague, George Norrie, is on the road. As we've mentioned before, George has a stage show that's been traveling around the country. It's a lot of fun. He was here in Las Vegas earlier this year, and I joined him, and it was a huge audience, and they had a great time. And the next stop is Asheville, North Carolina on the 25th. We're going to hear some details about that right now. Jonathan Berman, August 1953 or 63? Is it 53?
53.
Tell me what happens.
Well, before I get into that, George, I just want to take a moment, if I might, to say what I love about your show.
Sure.
I love that fact that you are able to be sort of a skeptic and yet a believer at the same time. And I can relate to that because I'm not the amazing Randy, but I like to look at things rationally, right? And at the same time, there are waves, right? There's radio waves and there are other waves, and I'm pretty sure of that. So I think that balance is hard to hold, and I commend you in the show, and I love your show. So that's the stance I tried to hold during this film, you know? So you could awake me one day, and I'll say George Van Tassel was a genius, and you could awake me the next, and I'll say, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy attitude to have. I really enjoyed your film. You had it was a good balance of telling the story without being too judgmental about the whole thing. It's enjoyable either way. If you want to really get down to it, did he really meet somebody from Venus? You know, you might have problems accepting that. Could he have met someone who said they were from Venus? Maybe. I don't have much problem with that.
Well, this goes back to a long conversation, right? You know, I see the ship of fools, right? That metaphor as being that unleashing of the crazies into the ocean on a ship, and that we lost something with that, with the Age of Enlightenment, and that connection to the madness helped guide the king. And I think we're missing that. So people have been seeing things for years, and whether they're real or not, I couldn't tell you. I have no alien here yet in my presence. But a lot of what George was working on was sheer genius. And he was grappling with life, and that's what we're all doing. So anyway,
I'm with you on that, by the way. I think that as we become more rational, we lose connection with understanding the world around us. You know?
Yeah, I mean, and George was, you know, in a way, he was the first, well, I could say the godfather of the Age of Aquarius, you know. The aliens, as you know, brought down this message, and that message was typically very similar, and it was usually of peace and love, and of certain warnings that we'll get into. Anyway, it's 1953, August. It's a full moon on the desert. A ship lands, and the being comes out, and he says, I am Sol Gonda, and I would be pleased to show you my craft. And by the way, his voice, according to George, was unlike the actor Ronald Colman. Some of your listeners may know. And he saw the spaceship coming up about 8 feet off the ground and was led into the craft and saw a buttered colored light coming from under it. And he was taken on a tour of the craft. And at that point, he was said he was given or downloaded the principles that would become the Integratron. And that dome and that construction of that dome machine would be his focus for the next 25 years.
Did they tell him anything about the future or make predictions or do any of the sort of alien editorials about quit blowing up nuclear bombs, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the messages were, you know, they started coming actually before Sol Gonda. They started coming in 52, and they were warnings, you know. They were okay with uranium, but the hydrogen element was another story. They were deeply concerned that the monkeying with the hydrogen bomb would destroy life on this planet, according to George. And, you know, I don't know if you've done anything with Robert Hastings, but
sure.
There's some interesting, more modern day follow-up to that, that there is some kind of overriding energy that is working with us to make sure we don't monkey up the universe.
So Bantasso gets this message. It changes the course of his life. And he starts sort of preaching it and sharing it with other people. And he has these sort of mass consciousness sort of meditations, I guess. And then he starts channeling, right? The voices come back and speak through him.
Well, he was already channeling. His religious sing-alongs had evolved into this channeling of 52. excuse me. I liken it to Tom Sawyer's fence, you know. He was like, hey, I've got this information from the aliens. I'm going to build this machine dome. Come and help me. So he had to gather his neighbors. Imagine, you know, if you go out to the high desert now, you can go out there and it's still pretty barren, right?
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine what it was like in the 50s. Wow.
So he doesn't have many resources. He starts sharing the message. He starts appearing on television, doing interview programs, and becomes pretty well known.
Yeah, and has to figure out a way to fund this, you know. And one of the ways is in 1954, a year later, he starts having the annual spacecraft conventions. And by the way, obviously before the internet, right? I really don't think George Van Tassel had Snapchat. You know, he had to get the word out there. So they had the spacecraft conventions, and they would invite all the famous contactees of the time. Adamski came one year, right? He wasn't sure. But people came, thousands of people came, and Doris Van Tassel made her apple pie, and George spoke, and other contactees spoke, and it was a good time. It was also an opportunity. I mean, imagine you're a contactee in the 50s with no connection to anyone else, and you're living in, I don't know, Wisconsin or something. I mean, here's an opportunity to meet and greet and share and not be alone anymore.
How'd they get the word out?
That's a great question. Well, as you said, George was very into publicity. One of the things that happened was in 1957, Life magazine, and I think we may be around the same age. I remember when Life was really a big deal, you know? It was the thing. And they did an article about the conventions, and it was kind of like the classic, right? I've noticed people always want to, even if they're interested in it, unless it's, you know, someone like you who really can get on the wavelength, they want to mock it first.
Sure.
So yeah. Life kind of mocked it and had these beautiful pictures by Ralph Crane, and then that it went in the other direction. People started showing up, you know, thousands of people, and the word got out.
How did you mention Adamski being there for one of these events? There were a couple of other really big names in the contactee movement in general. How did they get along? Was it a matter of, I see the competition in UFO circles these days, and there's a lot of backstabbing and turf
oh, really?
Wars and things of that sort. Oh yeah.
Oh, we'll have time to talk about that at some point over a year.
Yeah, that could be a film for you. But was it like that for these guys, for the contactees?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, one thing, George's channelings were so out there that some of the other contactees, from what I've read, felt he was almost making fun of him. I don't think he was. He was just on another plane, you know? So I think there was a good bon ami, you know? People were friends. You know, this was the mid-century, right? And it was a man's world. There wasn't that many women contactees. And, you know, guys are competitive by nature, I would say.
He starts talking about the Integratron, and no one spends more of their own money or ports more of their own energy into it than Van Tassel. There's a quote that you heard from one of his early interviews in which he defends it. It's not like he's a profiteer. He's skimming the top and getting rich off this thing. People donate to it, and he puts it into the construction. What does he tell them about what this thing is going to be?
Well, you know, the dome, as one reviewer of the film discussed it. It was like a Swiss Army knife of the New Age. it would act as a life extension machine, and there's some fascinating science behind that that I've been delving into more and more. And it would also be a time machine, and as well, it would act as the basic research for free energy.
And do you think, I mean, have you studied the engineering enough to think, to make a conclusion about whether there's a legitimacy to the design, whether there's anything to it?
Well, let's first start by saying I'm a professor of film and video.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Just to be clear.
Yeah. There's a reason I'm in journalism, too. It's called math. So
it's called math. Right. Well, on the I will say that what he was up to, the more you dig into it, the more intriguing it gets. I mean, it wasn't just the ideas from Solgonda he was working with. He was working with ideas from Tesla and from a few other scientists that were dealing with different kinds of waves, magnetic waves and electromagnetic waves, and you know, how they could all work together. It was a pretty complex situation. The science behind it, in George's words, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He wanted to apply George Lakovsky's multiple wave oscillator, okay, to Barnossi's, that was a couple, magnetic fields, and then saturate them with Tesla's ionization to charge our cell batteries. So the idea was, the initial idea of Krill was that our batteries were like cells. And by the way, Dr. George Krill was no slouch. He was the first surgeon to do a direct blood transfusion.
So he gets donations. They start building this thing. For those who haven't been to the Integratron, it's a pretty amazing structure. And it's built, as I remember it, it has no nails, no screws, no metallic parts at all, this great dome. And it's open. That's a whole sub-story that you tell in this film about other people who are drawn there years later who take over the place long after he's gone. Mm-hmm. And they've opened it for sound baths and meditation. And it is a really, I don't know if it's alien, but it sure is a strange place and has really unique qualities.
That's true. And, you know, you hear about the no metal thing, and that sounds like an aside. But as I look into it more and more, and, you know, you think a film is done when it's done, and it's not. Have you heard the expression that a poem is never finished, it's only abandoned? So that's the way I feel about this work. It just keeps going, and there's bonus material, you know, that I'm going through. This idea of the dome being built with this beautiful birch fir, right? The fir, giant birch pieces. It uses this construction that may look familiar to you. And do you know where you may have seen it?
It looks like Mount Palomar.
Yeah, Mount Palomar, okay. Maybe something by a friend, a close personal friend of George's, Howard Hughes, in the Spruce Goose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So it's very probable that George worked with and was inspired by Hughes. There's a process called, I think it's called Glunam, and it's these kind of being able to use the wood and bend it and use the resin to keep it in one place. So it was used on the Spruce Goose, and it was used on some other secret experimental craft.
So they have what's called these sound baths. And I experienced one of those, one of the visits I made there, and it's really an amazing effect. I wonder if that was on purpose. I mean, did he know, Van Tassel know, when he was building it, that it would have that sound quality?
Well, you've probably done shows on EMF.
Sure.
Sure. So these are multiple wave oscillations. Waves are, you know, they're sound waves or waves. So I would assume, but I couldn't tell you for sure, that George was aware of the conductivity of the space. And I do believe that if you sat in that space for 30 minutes with no bowls, you would still feel something. But the bowls really do add to the effect. And the stewards of the dome, the Carl sisters who run it now, are doing a great job on that. You know, it's a really kind of brilliant, different idea. The original idea was that it would spin around, right? That ring would spin, and you'd walk through it, and you'd come out rejuvenated. Who doesn't?
So there was there were supposed to be some other steps that were going to be taken to make this thing work that never happened for reasons that we'll get into on the other side in the second hour. But I wanted to backtrack just a bit. You have a USC professor that you interview for the film who describes sort of a desert consciousness, that sort of a mystical core that appeals to people. And then you have an interview with somebody who talks about Joshua trees and the weird synchronicity with Joshua trees. I think it's, I don't know if this is true, but the claim is that Joshua trees only grow in two parts of the world. One is Jerusalem and one is here. And they compare Jerusalem to heaven and this to hell, like, you know, opposite polar extremities. Your take on that?
Well, that quote, I don't believe is true. I am a fan. I think it was at Hearst who said, print the legend.
Yes.
It's just so
that was
poetic.
In Liberty Valance. Yeah.
It's so poetic. It's beautiful. But yeah, I mean, I love California. As a New Yorker who came out here and saw it in books and then it was real, it's just incredible. And the backstory is so amazing, right? You had that atomic bomb blast, and then you had that whole interplay between science, atomic bomb blast, of course, in New Mexico in 1945. And since that moment, there was all this activity around science and spirit. And California always had that, right? So people came out looking for the promised land, and they found a place in L.A., at least, of fast food and highways and disconnected communities. So there's always that hunger for spirituality, I would see, in Southern California. And when the new world of Formica, television, and all this stuff appeared in the mid-century, it was a different world. You had hungry seekers ever since people came to California. Of course, there were the original Mexican people who lived here, because this was Mexico, and the American Indians who lived here. But it was a land of seekers. You know, you saw that in many movements, you know, with Hubbard and all kinds of people. And also, a lot of the original, in the turn of the century, a lot of the original people looking at the skies, the astronomers, they were sons of clergy. So I just love all those, that context. Yeah, and Kevin Starr, he was the state librarian, and he really writes beautifully about California and makes those connections. So we were really privileged to have him in the film.
You quote an historian for the Morongo Indians, and I have heard, you know, but Native Americans, indigenous people talking about the star people, the sky people, and connections, but I had never heard this particular story that the Morongos believe that they were brought here from another planet and dropped off basically in the area around Joshua Tree. We're going to take a break and get into that story in a moment, and then talk about the semi-mysterious death of George Van Tassel and the FBI's ongoing interest in what was going on out there at Giant Rock. We're talking with Jonathan Berman about Calling All Earthlings, his film. We've got some information on how you can see the movie itself. We're going to take a break now.